B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
As the name of the podcast says, it's Don Dokken today on Talkin' Rock. Coming up on August 28th, they're releasing something special called the Lost Songs. 1978 to 1981, Don tells me all about the process of how this started. It's kind of like a prequel to Dokken. We talked a lot about the early days of Dokken, including George Lynch joining the band.
And he said about George, you know, George is a guitar player. And I said, yeah, he's a good guitar player, you know. And so they both flew over, and we wrote Breaking the Chains.
Don went in deep on the history of Dokken. Plus, we talked about the 90s and what happened to bands like his during that time of the grunge explosion.
My type of melodic hard rock was like passé, you know, so that, and I remember everybody died.
He also praised Lars from Metallica for fighting the fight against Napster.
When Lars said, if you allow this to keep happening, it will be the end of the music industry, Lars was right.
He also gives me an update on his health.
I wish I could, you know, give you good news.
And that's just for starters today with Don Dokken on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Entertaining interview today with the one and only Don Dokken on the Talkin' Rock with a Meltdown podcast. We'll get into it here in just a minute. It's kind of funny because I've had some really strange experiences with Dokken and Don Dokken, one of which I'll get into here in just a few minutes. Something that I'm sure is unique only to myself and Don in this crazy rock and roll business. But I'll get into that here in just a few. But I remember back in the late 1990s when they reformed with the original members, Jeff Pilson, Wild Mick Brown, and George Lynch and Don, of course. They were doing a signing here in Metro Detroit. And so they asked me if I would do an interview. And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And I kind of forgot about this when I talked to Don. By the way, this was last week when I talked to Don. But anyways, this was back, like, the internet was just starting out. And, you know, you didn't really know a lot about the inner workings of these guys' lives because it really wasn't out there as far as, you know, magazines and different things like that. So anyhow, as I'm talking to them, I remember that Jeff Pilson, the guitar player, or the bass player, I mean, he had been on the Janet Jones show. Is it Janet or Jenny Jones? I think it's Jenny Jones, back in the early 1990s. It was like a Jerry Springer-type talk show. And I remember the topic was something along the line of hot rock star wives. And so, anyways, this was like 1993, 94, somewhere around there. Could have even been 95 for all I know. Anyhow, so I'm in this record store in the back room or outside in the alley or something interviewing these guys. And it just pops into my mind. And so I say near the end of the interview, I said, hey, Jeff, are you still with your hot rock star wife? And I see the girl who's handling the band. She's like their publicist. She's doing the thing like with her hand going across the neck, like, no, do not bring this up. And he's like, oh, no. And he was real nice about it. He's like, no, I'm not with her anymore. And, you know, yada, yada, yada. So anyhow, so they walk back into the store to sign autographs and do whatever. And she takes me outside and she says, yeah, they're not together anymore. She's living with Mick Brown, the drummer. Well, of course, how am I supposed to know, right? It just popped into my head, the Jenny Jones show from back in the day and hot rock star wives. So anyways, like I said, that wasn't the only unusual thing to happen with Don Dokken and myself in our past. There hasn't been a lot of things, but there's been a couple things that have been a little bit on the unusual side. And something else coming up here is even more unusual. Before we get to that, real fast reminder, if you like this podcast, give it a 5-star rating, write reviews, Apple and iTunes and the whole thing. I do appreciate it. It does help out the podcast. So without further ado, and no more stupid stories from me, well, maybe just a couple more here during the interview, it's Don Dokken today on Talkin' Rock.
Everything's good. I mean, well, you know, the world's gone crazy, but other than that, it's good.
Other than that, yeah, everything's good. You know, it's funny. This is the one thing I'll always remember from my time with Don Dokken. I don't know if you recall this, but I may be the only person in this world that's ever picked you up in a hearse and taken you to a radio station for an interview.
In a hearse, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, you still have that hearse, the radio station hearse?
No, I don't have that hearse, but I'll never forget. You walked out. This was in Buffalo. And you walked out of the hotel and you stopped and you said, I thought I'd only be in one of these things once in my life.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Yeah, let's hope it's not for a long time. Right, there you go. So I always thought about that, and I never forget. That was shortly after Monster Rock, because you were touring Mirror Mirror with the guys from Trickster.
Yeah, they're opening up for me, and I just put my new band together with Peter Baltus on bass from Accept, and Mickey D from Motorhead, and John Norm from Europe, and Billy White was like a Austin, Texas guitar hero at 18. So it was a great band.
Yeah, I ran into Billy D in the hotel that day too, and I think there was like some sort of metal fest going on that night as well, because the guys from Sepultura and stuff like that were also in the hotel lobby. So, man, that was a long time ago, another lifetime ago. But let's fast forward here to 2020 and what you got going on now. You got the Lost Songs coming out August 28th. So tell us about this project.
Well, it's a trippy project, you know, because of the COVID, you know, our tour was canceled this summer. So I was just trying to write songs for the new album. We've been doing it like via Skype. And I have, you know, a lot of time on my hands. And I think a lot of people in the country got a lot of time in their hands. And I thought, well, it's time to clean the garage and the storage that I haven't touched in 25 years. So, you know, it was just full of crap. You know, and I bought a 64 Stingray convertible, and I had no room to put it in the garage, and I couldn't leave it outside. So I said, well, time to make room for another car. So I just started cleaning the garage out, and it was mostly old equipment, Marshall cabinets from the 80s, blown-up amplifiers, you know. So my girlfriend and I just started ripping it apart and trying to organize, and I ended up throwing away, honestly, about 2/3 of it. I'm like, do I need this? No. You know, if you don't go in your storage locker for 10 years and you're paying all that money and you don't go in there, it can't be worth too much.
Right.
So at the end of the day, there was just a bunch of boxes piled way, way, way at the back, and I opened up one of the boxes. It was like a plastic tub, and I saw 2-inch reels of tape in there, which kind of took me back, because I haven't recorded on 2-inch analog tape in about 25 years. So I pulled them out, and I saw some writing on them, and it said Hamburg, Germany, 1979, and said Hamburg, 1980, and it said, you know, Redondo Beach, 1978, and I'm like, what the hell is all this stuff? So a lot of people don't know, when a tape sits for 20 years, two decades, they start to decompose. So you have to stick them in a special oven, convection oven, bake them for about 3 hours. And you'll usually, even if you do that, you can put the tape on and maybe get one or two passes out of it before it just shreds and falls apart. So I did that and found somebody with a machine, and we baked it, and fingers crossed. And there was about 8 songs on the reels, and I got 4 out of it. The other ones just went to hell in a handbasket. So I found these songs, and I said, what is this stuff? And it was just songs I wrote when I was in my early 20s, way before the lineup of Lynch, Pilsen, Brown. And so I just thought, why not just finish them? I had vocals on it. I had guitars on it. I just need to put some real drums on it. It was a drum machine. And I just thought, why don't we just finish them just for shits and giggles?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, because you're the second person 2 days to tell me about some tapes they found in their garage and had to bake them and brought them back to life. John Anderson from Yes told me the exact same story yesterday about his latest project.
Oh. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. And even when Jimmy Page decided to redo the Led Zeppelin catalog, yeah, he had to bake all the tapes, and he remixed the whole all the Zeppelin catalog. It took him like a year. But yeah, tapes just don't last forever. It's tape, and it's magnetic. And so, you know, there was other songs on there, but they'd start to play and the machine would lock up, and then I'd rewind it, and then I'd start to play it and then it would lock up, and I went, oh, well. So I squeezed 4 songs out of it. There were some other songs that somebody had stolen back in the 80s, like some of my demos, and put a record out, a bootleg. And he made like $1 million on it. Never paid me a dime. Stole like 5 of my songs and put out an album and called something. And so that always pissed me off, because they weren't his songs. They were mine.
Right.
That I'd written in 1979, and somebody had nicked the tapes out of the studio in Hamburg and waited till we got famous and then put it out as a legit rockin' album, which it wasn't. So I took those songs and talked to my guitar player, and he said, dude, you own those songs, man. Why don't you remaster them, fix them up a little bit, and put some new solos, and put some real drums on it, better sounding drums. And I thought it was going to take me a couple of weeks to knock this out, but it ended up taking about 4 months, you know, because a lot of the songs there weren't masters to. And I heard them on YouTube. I heard some of them. People had copies of these demos, but I don't know where they got them, but they sounded terrible, you know, like a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, you know. So I finally hunted down the best versions I could find and put a compilation album together, and that's what this is.
Yeah, well, that's an unbelievable story. You totally forgot about those when you put them back on. I mean, all sorts of memories and stuff must have flooded right back, eh?
A lot of memories, and, you know, looking at the notes, you know, when I was working in Hamburg, Michael would write down what time we started the recording session. Usually it was about 2 or 3 in the morning because we were playing clubs, you know. We'd play at the club till 12 or 1, grab our gear, go to Michael Wagner's studio, and, you know, and go in the middle of the night on the DL, you know, and sneak in there and start recording songs. So, and we get out there at 6 in the morning with our tail between our legs. But, you know, the stuff just, when I got the record deal for Breaking the Chains, I just thought, well, you know, we're going to write new songs. And we did.
So you guys start up now. When did Dokken actually first start, the actual band Dokken? What year was that?
Which lineup?
I guess the original lineup. I mean, the best known lineup with George Lynch and all that.
Right. I went to Germany in 79 as a 3-piece. I was the guitar player and singer. Juan Crucier was the bass player who went on to go on with Rat.
Rat, right.
We went to Hamburg as a 3-piece, toured. I went back in 80, did one more little club tour. I don't know why somebody's calling me now. It's not their time yet. And, a lot going on in my life. So when I went back to Germany the second time is when I met Dieter Dierks, who was making the Blackout album. And it's when he asked me if I wanted to do some background vocals. I said, hell yeah. So I did a demo at his place, like 3 songs, and I got a record deal out of it. So in Germany. So my dilemma was, I have a record deal and I have no band. So it was just me. So that's when I called Mick and said, hey, I got this record deal. Do you want to play on the record? I'll fly to Germany and want to bang off this record. You'll be here for about a month. And he said, what about George? You know, you should get George as a guitar player. And I said, yeah, he's a good guitar player, you know. And so they both flew over, and we wrote Breaking the Chains. You know, we wrote it in an old bomb shelter under a hotel. We rehearsed in there and wrote the songs and did Breaking the Chains. So that would have been like late 1980. But the album still came out originally. People don't know that. Breaking the Chains came out as Don Dokken. The album cover is a picture of me on the cover, and it says Don Dokken because it was a solo album. So when we came back to America, and almost a year later, I got a record deal in America, and that's when I talked to George and Mick, and I said, you know, you want to make it a band? And they said, yeah. So I dropped the Don and called it Dokken, even though I've been calling it Dokken since 78. You know, way back when I did my very, very first record, was a little 45 single. And so that was that. And, you know, we did Breaking the Chains, dropped the Don, and off we were off and running, you know.
What, was there any other name suggested for the band, or did everyone just go, okay, yeah, Dokken's cool?
Well, it was supposed to be temporary. In the early 70s, I was playing clubs. The band was called Airborne. And several years when I was playing with Bobby Blotzer and stuff. He was a drummer. Had a lot of people in my band. Bobby Blotzer, Frankie Benelli for a time played with us, Juan Crucier. So it was Airborne, and then some band got signed to a record company called Airborne. And I went, well, that's the end of that. So, you know, so I couldn't call it Airborne anymore. So I just started using Dokken, you know, because it was an unusual name.
Yeah, I mean, hey, you know, rocking like docking, right? As they say, it's I mean, everyone remembers that name. I loved that when I saw you guys at Monsters of Rock. That tour, by the way, 32 years ago, that tour took place with you know Metallica, Scorpions, Van Halen, Kingdom Come. For those that don't know, that was unbelievable. But Sonny, you it sounds like you were pretty I didn't realize how you know tight you were with a lot of these guys that went on to be in successful other bands too, like you were just mentioning Frankie Benelli and Juan and all those guys. So you were pretty much ingrained in that society in that like the LA strip scene, so to speak, in the early 80s, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were all, you know, band hopping. It was very incestuous, you know. You know, I'd have a gig and I didn't have a drummer and I'd call Frankie Benelli and he goes, yeah, I'll do the gig, and he'd come in and play. And Bobby Blotzer played in the band, Redford went to Rat, and there was a lot of people kind of, everybody was kind of scrambling to see who was going to take off, because, you know, Van Halen got their deal in 78, and that album went through the roof. I think we all thought that when Van Halen got signed that, you know, they're going to start signing every band and their mother, but it didn't happen. There's a lot of, you know, documentaries about the L.A. strip and the whiskey and the Starwood and the Zaris, but that didn't happen. You know, there's a lot of people say it didn't, but it didn't happen. The reason I went to Germany was in 79, the new wave scene came in. You know, my Sharona's on the radio and the Knack and Devo and Blondie and, you know, the rock thing kind of died away. And there was two factions in the Hollywood scene. There was punk, like Black Flag and X and the Mentors and the Weasels, and there was that scene playing Madame Wong's. These were more like punk clubs. Mm-hmm. Then there was the new wave, and there was the new wave bands, you know, which, you know, cut all their hair off and wore shark skin jackets and pointy boots. And it wasn't my thing. You know, I go, you know, this is not what I do. And I met somebody that had a club in Hamburg, and he said, you know, I was into Scorpions and I was into Saxon and Judas Priest and you know, King Diamond, and these bands weren't popular in America then. So I decided to go to Germany. I figured I'd have a better, you know, at least people would appreciate what kind of music we were doing. So that's why I went to Germany in the first place, because the L.A. scene died for a couple of years. And, well, not died, but it was all new wave. And I was like, I'm not into this at all. So
what band turned that around?
You know, I don't really know. I just, they came, I think it was a fad for a while, and then, of course, Van Halen just went through the roof, and then they did the US Festival, and the guy that, you know, helped start Mac, and, you know, Macintosh Computers, I can't remember, Wozniak, and Steve Wozniak decided to put this big festival on, and he put all these rock bands on the bill, you know, Ted Nugent, and Van Halen, and I can't remember if it was Motley or not, but you know, there was a lot of bands that got on that festival, and it just seemed like the whole rock scene, I would say right when Breaking the Chains came out, the whole rock scene exploded on the Hollywood strip. But that, then again, and then it started to morph into more like, you know, glam rock, as they called it, or glam metal. You know, Poisons and the more pop bands like Winger and all those kind of bands. Well, I mean, Winger's album didn't come out to 1990.
Right.
A lot of people don't realize a lot of those bands have big hits. By the time all those, you know, commercial hard rock bands had their day in the sun, I was on my sixth world tour by then. You know, I'd already toured with AC/DC and God, you name it, and Judas Priest and Accept, and a lot of tours, mostly a lot in Europe, a lot in Japan. We got very famous in Japan. Of course, Bon Jovi hit the scene late 80s, you know. But so I was kind of, you know, 5 years ahead of the curve as we slowly fought our way up the chain, being, people used to call us Doc and his America's favorite support band.
I know I saw you open up for a lot of bands as a kid, growing up through the 80s and stuff. But what happens in the early 90s, you guys split up and George goes off and does Lynch Mob. You're doing, you know, you're Don Dokken with Mirror Mirror and whatnot. And then, like, the grunge scene comes in. I mean, what were your thoughts about it at the time?
Well, you know, it kind of put the kibosh, you know, when I did you know, I lost my name. You know, the three of them, when we broke up, you know, I was shocked that the courts would not allow me to call the band Dokken anymore. And I was like, but that's my last name.
Yeah.
And but the three of them sued me to not be able to use Dokken anymore. I went, all right. So I called it Don Dokken. That's the only reason I did that. Had no choice. And then that came out and was doing really well. We were selling out big places and we were doing good. And I remember I was on Geffen, and then they signed Nirvana and Guns N' Roses. And when Nirvana took off and Guns N' Roses, you know, took off, it was almost like people thought is my type of melodic hard rock was like passe, you know, so that, and I remember everybody died. I can name a million bands between 1991 and 1997 that just like broke up, went by the wayside, got into drugs, you know, the whole thing was Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, you name it. All those bands were having the Seattle sound took over. So that I just kind of like disappeared for a while after my, from the Ashes album. I just kind of went home and rode my Harley and worked in my garden and, you know, did like everybody else, you know, had a couple kids and was just living my life, you know, living my life and hanging out at the beach and, you know, and playing with my toys. So, and then in 97, all of a sudden you get this resurgence because, you know, MTV gave us all our break. And when MTV started to die, there was no avenue for any new bands. And all the new generation, I laugh because, like, I tell my daughter who's 33 years old, and I go, you know, there was a day not so long ago we didn't have internet and cell phones. And she's like, what are you talking about? They've always had it. And I'm like, no, I swear to God, I'm telling you, in the 80s, there was no internet. If you wanted to write a letter to somebody, you had to write them a letter. And if you wanted to call them, you had to call them on a cell, you had to call them on a payphone or call them from the hotel at $4 a minute. There were no cell phones. And she just couldn't grasp the fact that there was ever a world without social media, free downloads, Napster, Spotify. You know, they didn't relate to that. They just figured it had always been that way. But it wasn't. And it hurt us, you know. That's the problem, is when the internet, you know, especially Napster, they killed us. You know, you bust your ass for 9 months, make a great record, you put it out on Monday, and on Wednesday it's a free download. It hurt us, you know.
Yeah,
financially.
I've talked to Dee Snider about this before, but you know, I asked Dee because he was fighting the PMRC. I said, so you could kind of see where Lars was coming from. He's like, absolutely. So Lars he kind of took the bullet for all you guys, didn't he?
He took the bullet, and I give him high praise. He had the balls to go in front of Congress, and he was a soothsayer. When Lars said, if you allow this to keep happening, it will be the end of the music industry. And he was right. Lars was right. And then, you know, always people say, oh, man, it's Metallica. They're rich. They're famous. You know, what do they care if some people download their stuff for free? They're making millions. That wasn't his point. You know, if I spent a year painting a painting, an oil painting, and a year of my life and all the materials, and I get it done, and I go to sell it at an art gallery, and I show up, and somebody outside the gallery's got, you know, 80 copies of it on a poster for $5, that's not fair, you know?
Right.
It's my art, my music. You have no right to take my art and give it away.
And speaking of Lars, the other day, he talked, somebody asked him, I don't know if somebody asked him or he just posted this online or whatever, but he talked about the definitive Metallica song. So I'll ask you, what's your definitive song and perhaps your definitive album of your career?
Well, as far as Metallica goes, obviously it's the Black Album.
No, I'm talking about from your stuff, from your Dokken catalog.
Oh, my stuff, yeah. Definitive? God. You know, that's a really tough question. It's kind of like asking me that I've got 8 kids and which one's your favorite.
You got to have favorites. I have one and I only have 2. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, it's like, what's your favorite kid? But, you know, I mean, we play the hits. I still like the songs that I wrote, like, in 20 minutes. Like, In My Dreams, I remember writing that on a beach down in Mexico on my acoustic guitar. It literally took me 20 minutes to write it. And I still think it's a good melodic, you know, rock song. Into the Fire, I also wrote in like 45 minutes. And some of the songs would take weeks. But I don't really have a definitive rock song because there's, you know, we're kind of a schizophrenic band. People think of us as of the MTV days of It's Not Love, In My Dreams, The Hunter, Dream Warriors, you know, these commercial rock songs. But we have this heavy side to us. When Heaven Comes Down, Kiss of Death, Tooth and Nail, Paris is Burning, you know, Till the Living End, all these double bass metal type songs. And that's probably what did us well because we got to tour. We weren't touring with Poison. We never toured with Motley Crue. We never toured with the Warrants or the Wingers or any of those bands. We were touring with AC/DC. We were touring with Judas Priest. You know, we were touring with the heavy bands. So that, because we had that heavy side to us, you know, so that kind of helped our career to be able to play arenas with the more metal bands.
So speaking of playing, I got a couple more things here for you, then we'll cut you loose. I know you got some other stuff going on. You played a socially distanced concert a few weeks ago. How did that go?
Yeah, we did two of them.
Yeah.
I think we were the only two concerts to happen in the whole United States.
What was it like looking at it from on stage?
Well, you know, I mean, they did it right. It was about a 5,000 outdoor seat venue, and the government or the governor capped it at 2,500. And they took everybody's temperature coming in, and they checked everybody for COVID, and everybody was spaced out 6 to 8 feet. He had plenty of room on the lawn. It was an outdoor show. So everybody was, no, I wouldn't say everybody was wearing a mask. You know, the people that went to the front of the stage, a lot of them weren't wearing masks, and that was kind of discerning. But, you know, everybody just kind of behaved themselves, you know, and wore their masks and stayed apart from each other. And but then the people in the front, I'd look down, I go, holy shit, man, as much people no masks on. But, you know, we were 20 feet away from them, so I wasn't real worried about it. You know, I was more concerned about 6 plane flights in 3 days.
Right.
You know, that's where you can catch it. But according to my son, that's even harder. He's a pilot for JetBlue, and he flies a A300, and he said, all that air in the plane, Dad, is going through HEPA filters. You're not going to catch it. But everybody in the airport had a mask on. Everybody on the plane, mandatory, you have to wear a mask. So, you know, I pulled it off. I still quarantined when I came home. But it was cool to play. After 5 months, I was glad to be on stage again, you know, and we did 2 back-to-back. So now we actually have 2 shows in September in Texas, and we have 2 shows, 1 in Michigan and 1 Ohio in October. And then I told the boys, let's call it a day. Let's just do these 4 shows and social distancing. And I think we should just concentrate on the new studio album and wait to see what the hell happens with the vaccine or whatever, you know.
And so you were supposed to play dates this year with George playing some songs on each show, right?
Yep. It was going to be a great tour. It was going to be Lynch Mob, Lita Ford, Dokken. George was going to play, and then Lita, and then George was going to come on stage and play the last 4 songs with us. And, you know, everybody was excited. And George and I did do 3 shows together like that. We did 3 shows together. It was great. Everybody was getting along. It was all great. And then the frickin' corona hit, and it killed the whole tour.
Yeah. Final thing here for you. So, you know, obviously your health has been an issue in the press lately with your hands and different things. How are you making out?
I wish I could, you know, give you good news, but my right hand and arm is still paralyzed after 7 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I go to physical therapy, you know, down the road to the hospital. I'm doing physical therapy and trying to get my fingers to move. But, you know, the biggest depression for me or sad thing is I can't play guitar anymore. You know, my hand doesn't move. So they say it could come back in a year, year and a half. I can only hope for the best. But, you know, it's been set. First they said 6 months, and now it's been 7 or 8. And, you know, I mean, I've got a little bit of movement. I can move my fingers a little bit. But my arm, you know, I have no muscles, strength at all. So I don't know what happened, man. I had surgery on my spine, went to the best guy, supposedly, at Cedars-Sinai. And he fucked me up, to be blunt.
Mm.
You know, I had to laugh. Like, it's kind of not funny, but I remember I was going into surgery. It was like 5.5 hours. And I said, last thing I said to him before he put me out is, just do me a favor. Don't paralyze me.
Yeah.
You know, but lucky when I came out of surgery, both my hands were paralyzed. So I got my left hand back. It's weak, but I'm lifting weights and doing exercises. So my left hand, where I play the guitar and fret, that's moving. I got all that back. It's just weak. But my right hand, I still can't hold a pick or sign my name or hold a fork. It's paralyzed. What can I tell you?
Man.
So all I can do is hope for the best. It was something I never saw coming. They told me I had to have the surgery on my neck because the spine was compressed. You know, I've been feeling weird for about 2 years. My fingers were tingly and my fingers were getting numb. And I'd ride my Harley and it seemed like it was getting harder and harder to pull the clutch in and hold on to the throttle. I was losing strength in my hands. And, you know, I drew the short straw, man. And it shouldn't have happened with my arm. And I suppose he got the best guy. I'd love to tell you his name and everybody can throw rotten tomatoes at him, but I won't. And it didn't come out. Yeah, it didn't work out. And I've been to 10 doctors and they said, we don't get it, man. Why your right side's parallel. We just don't get it. And so I'm just going to hope that, you know, over the next year, the nerves grow back and connect. And maybe in a year and a half, I'll be playing guitar again and piano.
Well, I really hope so, man. It's unfortunate when stuff like that happens to people like you that do this for a living. I just talked to a Janet Gardner here last thing, and I said, yeah, what do you know about Don? She goes, the power of his voice, the vulnerability, she says, you were one of her favorites back in the day. Super talented, she said. And she said she wrote a Harley or two with you guys back in the day.
Yes, she did. And that was the thing, you know, when I had my surgery, they said, well, we usually go through the front of your neck.
Right.
And not the back, but you're a singer. And we don't want to take the risk because you still have your tonsils. And we're worried that we might damage your vocal cords. So we're going to go through the back, but that's a lot more tricky. So I said, they told me, pick front or back. And I went, and I kind of said, well, if I lose my voice, it's over. You know, if I can't go, yay,
yeah.
I'm done. So, you know, I said, okay, we'll go through the back. And, you know, they split me open like a turkey and, you know, it just didn't work out so well. I just drew their short straw. So a lot of people have had the surgery and been fine and I can only hope. But, you know, I look at it, I play guitar for 50 years. If I can't play guitar anymore, I got John Levin on guitar. He's been in the band over 20 years and I'll go on stage and sing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's what I'll do. I'm known for a singer more than a guitar player. It's just hard writing a new record when I can't pick up my guitar and write a fucking song, you know.
I hear
so that's
you.
A little.
Well, Don, it's been a great talking to you, man. It's a lot has happened since that ride in the hearse in 1991. but
now, why did you have a hearse? What was the deal with that?
Because I was a broke young kid just starting out in radio, and my car was always broken, and they asked me to go pick you up at the hotel. And all I had was the station vehicle, which was that hearse. You walked out with a guitar in your hand in the case and in a manila envelope with some guitar magazines in it. And you sat next to me and I was riding to Buffalo and I never forgot this. I thought, you know, I'm going to tell this story someday, so I better start talking to you. So I started talking and you were nice enough to put your magazines away and you started talking to me. And then I took you to the venue and went and saw the show that night. It was awesome. And, you know, I remember when you walked into the radio station, the guys from Trickster were in the studio, and as soon as they saw you, it was almost like they had this mad respect, and they just kind of stood up, and they go, okay, well, Don's here. We'll see you guys later, you know? And then you walked in and did your interview, so.
They were young kids. They were very sweet, and I was kind of like the dad of the tour. And after every show, and I'd always go on the Trickster bus, and I'd tell them war stories, and they'd just sit there, is this all true? And I said, everything I'm telling you is true. And I apologize for some of the things I've told you. It was the 80s, man. It was the 80s, you know?
Hey, man. It was a life well lived, right?
It was a wild and woolly time in the 80s. And these kids were like still in high school, you know, had their hit. And I tell them, you know, what went on, you know, backstage on the bus, on the road. And they're just like, you know, just just jaw-dropping. And now I see these guys every couple of years, and they go, I miss those stories, Don. I miss all your rock and roll decadent stories.
Man, I guess you got to put out a book or a documentary or something sometime in the future.
Yeah, I'm going to do an autobiography at some point. Everybody else has. But the dilemma, I've had an offer for years to do one because there's unauthorized documentaries. But my dilemma is I don't want to write a book like Motley did, you know, about heroin overdoses and needles in the arm and drug abuse, because I never did drugs, so I don't relate to it. And, you know, I drank my fair share of Jack Daniels, but I would write a book. But if I tell the truth and tell all the stories of what I really know, what happened, people are going to be pissed at me.
Did you see the dirt? So, did you watch it?
Yeah, I watched it and I read it.
Yeah. I mean, was
and
that,
I'm like, wow, was they're pretty honest.
Yeah. Yeah, you must have saw those guys in an altered state several times.
Oh God, we used to go to the Rainbow, and you know, Motley would come see Doc and play. Like, I remember we played with Aerosmith on the Permanent Vacation tour, and it was the Who's Who of rock stars at the Aerosmith Doc and show at the Forum, and it was Motley Crue, Rat, you name it, every rock star, and Bon Jovi was there. All these people were in town and came to see the show. And of course, you know, we played early, so we all headed for the Rainbow. And by 12 o'clock, you could literally walk in the Rainbow, and every single booth is like, well, there's David Lee Roth. There's Eddie Van Halen. There's Rob Halford. There's John Bon Jovi. It was just packed full of rock stars. And then all these girls, of course, are in tow, you know, wanting to get into the Rainbow. And it got pretty crazy. There was a point in my life that I remember it like it was yesterday. I couldn't go in the Rainbow. You know, people bothered me too much. So they had this little table that held like four people, and me and David Lee Roth and maybe John or Halford, we'd all go in the kitchen, and we'd eat in the kitchen. so we'd eat in the kitchen, this little table Mario set up for us, because you know, you try to eat, and you got a mouthful of spaghetti, and someone walks up and always says the same thing. Sorry to bother you, Mr. Dawkins, but can I have an autograph? And I'm like, can I put down to swallow my food? You know, so it got kind of frustrating. So we used to eat in the kitchen pot. I remember that like it was yesterday.
Man, I can just imagine some of the stories of the women that must have gone in that place that you must have left with.
No, I don't remember any of that.
We'll leave it on that. Hey, Don. I'm sorry. Go ahead. What?
I'm not copping to anything.
Hey, listen, man. Hope you get back out on your Harley pretty soon. I've got my Street Glide here with me today. I love my Harley Davidson, and man, it's and hopefully get back on stage pretty soon. But thanks so much for the time. The new record, the Lost Songs, drops on August 28th, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Michigan.
And I think you'll like it. It's pretty cool, man. There's some good. You'll hear a lot of like Deep Purple influence, a little bit of Priest. My guitar solos were very Blackmore influenced, and you can hear the influence of the late 70s, and I think you'll like it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Don. Thanks for the time, and good luck with your health and everything else like that, okay?
Thank you, buddy. Take care, Meltdown.
There he is, the one and only Don Dokken today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. If you're into the Don Dokken type thing, I talked to Janet Gardner last week. That was really cool. Talked to John Anderson from Yes. Actually talked to Jean-Paul from Clutch as well. We've had some great interviews lately. Rick Emmett from Triumph. So go back and check out some of those interviews. And plus, subscribe to the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. That helps a lot as well. But I hope you guys enjoyed that. Yeah, the hearse thing is so funny because, I remember, like I said before in the beginning, he walks out of the hotel. He's kind of like just stopped. He's like he had this look on his face, like, you want me to get in this to go to the radio station? It's in the middle of wintertime. Thing had bald tires. I'm like sliding all over the road. But he was a good sport about it. And that's a really, really funny. That was a really funny story. Anyways, I've got an interview at least scheduled right now with one of the biggest names in rock right now coming up later on this week, maybe as early as tomorrow. So check back. I think I'm going to try to throw it together tomorrow real fast. before I cut out of work tomorrow night. So for a Tuesday, anyways, as I record this. Hey, listen, thanks so much for checking out Talking Rock with Meltdown. We'll do it all over again, like I said, hopefully very, very soon. And thank you so much for listening.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.